Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 on this lovely Sunday, November 18th, 2007. Today we have, I think, perhaps the most anticipated show in Media Matters' 5.5-year history, certainly on the short list of candidates for that honor. We're going to be talking live with Naomi Klein, author of the new book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. We'll have her for an entire hour here on AM 580. But first, before we go to Naomi Klein and discuss her new book, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Up in the morning in the California sun!
Up in the morning in the California sun!
Gonna strike all day till the striking is done!
Gonna strike all day till the striking is done!
About 12,000 movie and television writers represented by the Writers Guild of America East and West went on strike last week. Writers are picketing in Hollywood and New York. At issue is how writers will be paid for content they create as it is viewed in new media venues. Currently, writers are paid residuals, flat rate fees every time their show is aired on TV. As the market turns from the click of a dial to clicking a mouse, writers are asking for a percentage of the sale when their work is downloaded or streamed from the internet into computers, cellular phones, and portable devices like MP3 players. But the studios have taken a hard line. John Bowman is the chairman of the Writers Guild Negotiating Committee.
When you have a management that's as intransigent and as wrong and unwilling to be flexible as this one is, it unites us as much as anything does. I think this is an issue that crosses TV writers, screenwriters. Everybody knows how important the future is, how important the internet is. Everybody knows this is our one last chance. And they're sort of putting our backs up against the wall, and nobody's backing down.
The first casualties of the strike have been the late-night talk shows. In the coming weeks, top-rated primetime shows will begin to feel the strain. So far, reality shows, sports shows, and news programs will not be directly affected by the walkout. In solidarity with the writers, some writer-producers who run TV programs said they did not intend to perform any of their duties while the writers' strike continued. And about 500 unionized news writers at CBS are expected to vote to authorize a strike, potentially joining their creative colleagues on the picket line. The writers are represented by Writers Guild of America East and have been working under an expired contract since April 2005. Given the high stakes, the strike could continue for some time. The last strike in 1988 lasted 5 months. You can find these videos and more information about the strike at unitedhollywood.blogspot.com.
This week, FCC Chairman Kevin Martin proposed new rule changes that would gut the long-standing prohibition on owning a daily newspaper and broadcast stations in the same media market. Democratic Commissioners Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein called the proposal a wolf in sheep's clothing that could ultimately repeal the ban in every market in America. Last week, the Senate Commerce Committee held a media ownership hearing at which numerous senators expressed their frustration with Martin's unrelenting push to get media ownership rules despite overwhelming public opposition. Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan from North Dakota and Republican Senator Trent Lott from Mississippi have introduced bipartisan legislation that would halt the FCC's rush, saying that they believe localism and diversity of media ownership is vital in a democracy.
We need to get this right. And in my judgment, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, having not completed the proceeding on public interest, having not completed the proceedings on localism, is not in a position where he can credibly suggest we ought to have a rule completed by the Federal Communications Commission on December 18th dealing with media ownership. That is not a thoughtful approach and not the right way to proceed.
The Media Ownership Act of 2007 requires the FCC to complete a separate proceeding on localism and create an independent minority ownership task force before moving forward with any changes to media ownership limits. The bill would also give the public a 90-day comment period on any new rules. Senators co-sponsoring the bill include presidential candidates Barack Obama, Joe Biden, and Hillary Rodham Clinton, as well as Olympia Snowe, John Kerry, Bill Nelson, Maria Cantwell, and Dianne Feinstein. On November 9th, the FCC held its final public media ownership hearing in Seattle. Despite Chairman Martin's attempt to squelch public input by giving barely a week's notice for the hearing, more than 1,100 people kept the FCC commissioners busy for 9 hours as they spoke out against further media consolidation. Washington Governor Kris Gregoire said she was opposed to further concentration.
Such concentrations stifle creativity. They stifle content. It narrows perspectives available to each of us as citizens. And it is clearly unhealthy in a society that rests on principles of equality and diversity. I find it ironic that in an age with so many new ways for people to communicate and so many ways to exercise the literal beauty of democracy, we face the very real threat that those new ways will be controlled by but a few.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. Based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois today, as I said at the top of the hour, we have as our guest someone we've been trying to get on the show for a while, someone who's been on the show before and has written, I think, one of the most important and most provocative books in years for a general readership. Our guest is the journalist Naomi Klein, author of the brand new book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Naomi Klein, welcome to Media Matters.
Great to be with you, Bob.
Well, you know, this book is an enormous book and a phenomenal undertaking representing years of work. And there's so much material in here. I think we could do one of those Jerry Lewis telethons and do like 24 hours. I mean, because literally for people who are going to read this book or thinking about reading it, there's a history of the world of the last 25 years in many respects, and a lot of the crucial developments put into a context and an argument that I have never seen done like this before. And it's in my view, convincing, but also, in anyone's view, provocative and worth discussing. Let's start right with it. What do you mean by the shock doctrine?
What I mean by the shock doctrine is a philosophy of power. The philosophy is that the best time to push through unpopular, pro-corporate policies, often called economic shock therapy. So I'm talking about a radical, a no-holds-barred program of corporate change is in the aftermath of a shock. So the book is really a challenge to the central claim of the right over the past 25 years, which is that free markets and free people go hand in hand, and that Reaganomics has spread throughout the world on the wings of freedom and democracy. What I'm showing in the book is that at all of the key junctures when this ideology has leapt forward, when this pro-corporate agenda has leapt forward, there has been some kind of a crisis or shock that prepared the ground and created a context, a state of emergency, a crisis atmosphere, which weakened or suspended democracy, allowing these sort of emergency economic measures to be pushed through.
And in the book, probably one of the central figures is that of Milton Friedman, the late economist from the University of Chicago, who plays a central role in providing the intellectual and almost theological developments that took place, or justification for the developments for what has taken place. And when I was raised in a family where those sort of politics were widespread, and the vision that was presented of Milton Friedman's conservative free market economics, or what's come to be called neoliberalism, is one of small government, individual freedom, free markets, private enterprise. That's a pretty misleading picture of Milton Friedman's recipe for the human condition, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly a misleading characterization of what actually happens when Milton Friedman's advice is taken. What you end up with is big government overspending, but not in the interests of people. You end up with these direct transfers of wealth from public to private hands, a sort of collusion between big government and big business, which is what we have at the moment in the United States. But we see it in many of the key laboratories where Milton Friedman offered hands-on advice, or where his disciples had key policymaking roles. So you actually end up in situations where you have a lot of interference in the state in terms of controlling the population, surveillance, erosion of civil liberties, big government and big business monopoly, so actually the antithesis of the free market. And corruption is really the hallmark of what happens in countries that take this advice, starting in Chile in the 70s, through Russia and much of Eastern Europe in the 90s, through China, and culminating in Bush's America.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Chile, Naomi Klein, because it's there, of course, that Milton Friedman got in the Milton Friedman School of Chicago economists really put themselves on the map and developed what was later acclaimed widely as the great
victory.
Yeah,
and I mean, I want to be clear that, you know, I don't really have it out for Milton Friedman in any kind of personal sense. I think that Milton Friedman, he was really not that original a thinker when it came to these radical ideas. He was a disciple of Friedrich von Hayek, who also believed in this vision of the world in which the markets dominate every aspect of life. In some ways, it's simply an adaptation of Adam Smith. But what Friedman was a phenomenal popularizer and a mm-hmm. phenomenal propagandist, and by all accounts, a very seductive educator as well, very charismatic. But the significance of Friedman in the University of Chicago is not the power of one man. You know, this isn't a book that buys into the theory of, you know, the great men theory of history. What the significance of the University of Chicago, and it's clearest in relation to Chile, is that the University of Chicago was a wing of U.S. foreign policy, in some sense, a wing of the State Department at a really key moment. And what I mean by that is the influence of the University of Chicago and Milton Friedman is fairly uncontested when it comes to Chile. There was the overthrow of Salvador Allende's democratically elected socialist government in 1973. Pinochet came to power and immediately lifted a group of Chilean economists known as the Chicago Boys to key positions. They eventually occupied the position of finance minister, head of the central bank, and they imposed a Friedmanite economic revolution in Chile after the coup, and Milton Friedman himself traveled to Chile and met with Pinochet, and I have letters between Pinochet and Friedman posted on my website, shockdoctrine.org. So this is all very well documented, but I think what's less understood is the way in which this collaboration came about, and it came about because the State Department in the 1950s was worried about Latin America, and particularly Chile's shift to the left, and the rise of what they called the pink economists. And they were worried about this because the theories of developmentalism and import substitution that were gaining ground under these so-called pink economists represented a real threat to U.S. multinational corporations invested in Chile, because these economists were advocating policies like nationalization of key resources like the phone system, like the mines, and so on. This idea was developed between the head of USAID's office in Chile and the head of the University of Chicago's economics department, that they would bring a group of Chilean students to study under Milton Friedman and his colleagues, precisely because they were so radical. And the idea was is that they would go back to Chile as sort of ideological warriors. So the influence of the University of Chicago and Friedman's influence was really created and nurtured by the U.S. government more than, you know, just attributing this to the power of one man.
And getting to Chile, I mean, what was striking as I read your book, and it was just really the sort of the opening salvo of the shock doctrine being developed, was that they instituted a series of extraordinary radical reforms of the Chilean economy and the Chilean political system, none of which were popular, but all of which came in on the heels of this brutal dictatorship and military coup.
Yeah, I think it's something that isn't fully understood. We tend to think of Pinochet's coup as simply being an attempt to reverse the socialist advances made under Allende. But the Chicago Boys saw it as a revolution in its own right, that this was their revolution, and they were going to make their professors back at the University of Chicago very, very proud by turning Chile into the first living laboratory for strict Friedmanite economics. And what's significant about that, that needs to be understood, is that at this point, and here we're talking about the early 70s, the ideas that Friedman and Hayek, you know, were developing at the University of Chicago were purely theoretical. The United States was still very much in the grips of Keynesianism, and by their own account, in the 1950s and 60s, they were a marginal band of radicals who didn't have, you know, any influence on policymakers. Eventually, they thought their time had come when Nixon came to power, and Friedman was fairly close to Nixon and was a policy advisor. But Nixon disregarded Friedman's advice and imposed wage and price controls and declared we're all Keynesians now. And Friedman was so distraught that he, in the end, declared Nixon the most socialist government, the most socialist president the United States had ever had, which is simply to say that, you know, that the Chicago School ideologues were in a state of high frustration because their grand ideas, their vision for a sort of fundamentalist market where everything is in balance and supply communicates with demand as the moon pulls the tides, you know, they could show it in their beautiful models in the basement of the, you know, social sciences building at the University of Chicago, but they didn't have a country to prove it in, and that is what Chile represented after the coup. And it's so interesting to look back at the policies that they did impose. I mean, they're very familiar in this moment. There's a flat tax, a 15% flat tax, privatization of Social Security, if any of this sounds familiar, charter schools, school vouchers. Really, it's the wish list, the Republican wish list, some of which they have still not been able to impose in the United States.
Our guest today, Naomi Klein, author of the new book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, just published by Metropolitan Books, a bestseller and one that certainly is commanding a lot of attention around not only the country but the world. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Naomi Klein, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open right now. Please call in if you have any questions. You know, Naomi Klein, I remember very well in the early 1990s when Francis Fukuyama was writing books like The End of History, when in popular parlance in the United States, it was presented widely, and I think in academic and intellectual circles as well, if not more so, that the entire world had embraced neoliberal economics, that Eastern Europe, Latin America, China, the entire world had understood the folly of anything except market-driven economics, and any policies that went away from that were very unpopular with the bulk of the people of the world, because the people of the world understood these were the policies that promoted growth and freedom. Mm-hmm. And I think your book might be the single strongest renunciation of that conviction I've ever seen.
The time has come, you know, because we really have been living with a lie, and that claim, the bundling of this radical economic vision that is, in fact, deeply unpopular around the world, with the very idea of freedom and democracy, I really think is the single most successful propaganda coup of our time, and it must be debunked. It must be delinked and debundled. You know, one of the things that's really striking about the claim is, and this, you know, comes up again and again, what I refer to as the fairy tale version of history or the official story. It's come up most recently now in Alan Greenspan's autobiography, where he talks about the defining moment for the triumph of this radical economic system being the fall of the Berlin Wall. And explains, and this is something that will be familiar to many of your listeners, that when the wall fell, and so many East Germans flooded across the wall and wanted to live in West Germany, and the world was able to compare and contrast the system in East Germany and the system in West Germany, the ideological battle was over, and then this free market model swept the world. You know, what's amazing about that story is the way in which it shows this concerted attempt to blur the lines between a mixed economy and the radical Friedmanite free market economy that mm-hmm. someone like Alan Greenspan has been advocating. Mm-hmm. Which, and you see it most clearly in this East German versus West German comparison, because you know, I would absolutely agree that the fall of the Berlin Wall was hugely significant, and what was collapsing there was any claim that a totalitarian communist state was desirable. But what was it that was so desirable in West Germany? It certainly wasn't Reaganomics. I mean, West Germany was a classic Keynesian mixed economy with elements of socialism within it, like public health system, public education system, very strong trade unions, very strong labor protections, many of which still remain and are still fiercely protected by German workers. So this has been the great trick, really, has been actually to use successful mixed economies to sell a radical version of capitalism that exists to dismantle those very protections that make that mixed system so seductive. The fact that you do have a market system, but you have the basic protections guaranteed, the protections for human dignity, health care, housing, food, and so on.
And in the book, The Shock Doctrine, Naomi Klein, you have a long discussion of Poland in the 1980s under Solidarity, and it's sort of transitioned from being at one time really a democratic socialist force almost entirely to eventually advocating over the opposition of the great bulk of the Polish people and certainly its voting base of neoliberal policies of privatization. It's an extraordinary and, from my point of view, very depressing section of the book.
Well, it is. I think in many ways that, you know, the book starts in Latin America, where you have these clear cases of countries that were developing these third way models, and they were doing it democratically, having those democracies overthrown in military coups, and then a counter-revolution led by the Chicago Boys. And the reason why I start the book there is because that is the single most persuasive challenge to the claim that democracy and free markets go hand in hand, because in these cases you had to overthrow democracy in order to have a free market revolution, and you needed torture and various forms of state terror to enforce this economic system. So it was wildly anti-democratic, which is why in the official story of how this economic model spread throughout the world, its advocates usually front-date it to Thatcher and just try to forget about the 70s, because it is such a damning indictment of that central claim. But yeah, I think that it is, you know, in those cases where you can see clearly that, you know, violence was used to overthrow these attempts at a progressive third way, it's almost less depressing than those cases where a leadership of a liberation movement sells out its base, and that's what happened in Poland in 1989 when people elected this inspiring workers' party that had positioned itself as the alternative, the middle ground between totalitarian communism and what Lech Walesa, the Solidarity leader, called the evils of capitalism. He said that in an interview with Barbara Walters in 1989. But then once they came to power with this historic election victory, they then turned around and imposed economic shock therapy. You know, we're still feeling the reverberations of that disillusionment, you know, because once people become disillusioned with the possibility of a progressive alternative, and they're also disillusioned with capitalism, you know, in Poland, the youth unemployment rate is 40%, then they turn to whatever's left. And, you know, what's left is fascism. And we see a very disturbing rise of far-right policies in Poland.
Our guest today, Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, the book just published this year by Metropolitan Books. She's joining us live on the phones. The phone number here is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. 800-516-9455. We've got a couple of callers who've been very patiently waiting to go on there, so let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Hello. This is a thrilling subject. I want to tell Ms. Klein how excited and happy I was reading your article in The Nation where you indicate country after country in Latin America standing up to this whole forced feeding of a system that doesn't work for them. Ecuador, Colombia, all of these, and going way back to Oscar Oliveira and Cochabamba and throwing Bechtel out of their country. The whole area of tying loans or benefits to privatizing what had been public services and you'd think ought to be is something that was also a condition of loans from the World Bank and IMF, and we don't hear about that a lot, but this is important that we know that people are standing up to it. It's so inspiring. I went on a trip with people from American Friends Service Committee to Nicaragua and El Salvador in 1990, and this was 5 months after Violeta Chamorro was elected. The revolution was ended, and there were no medicines in the hospitals. That sort of thing, and education was privatized, and so on and so forth. Thank you so much for your inspiring writing. I look forward to the book.
Thank you for your call. That article that you're mentioning is actually an excerpt from the final chapter of the book on shock resistance and focusing particularly on Latin America. And you know, the book really comes full circle in this way, in that it starts in Latin America as the first laboratory for the shock doctrine, and ends in Latin America because Latin America as the first laboratory is also the first part of the world to come out of shock and to develop alternatives to this economic model, but also develop what I call shock absorbers, ways of protecting themselves, new ways of protecting themselves from future shocks, like cutting ties with the IMF and the World Bank, like no longer sending students to the School of the Americas, or Ecuador's President Rafael Correa's recent announcement that he will not be renewing the lease on the U.S. military base in Ecuador, which is the largest U.S. military base in Latin America, he says, unless Ecuador is allowed to open a military base in Miami. And Correa is interesting. He's actually he gets a lot less attention than Morales and Chavez, of course, because he's a more low-key figure. He was elected a year ago, and one of the first things he said when he was elected, when he was asked what his economic program would be, he said, let's put it this way, I'm no fan of Milton Friedman's.
Well, you know, he is actually a PhD from the University of Illinois.
That's true. That's true.
So he's one of our own down there.
You know,
and I think
he should be very proud.
It's really appropriate, Naomi Klein, that you end on Latin America and begin with it, because drawing out the tension between democracy, self-government, and these shock policies, these neoliberal privatization policies, these crony capitalist deals.
Mm-hmm.
And it really has come back in Latin America now with this wave of popular elections explicitly on platforms to reverse and reject this entire series of neoliberal policies of privatization across in country after country. How, I mean, from your experience looking, and I think Chavez in Venezuela is the most famous of these instances because of the oil money and because of Chavez's, embattled administration against tremendous organized opposition both within and without. How does the dominant Thomas Friedman type thinking, and I pick on Friedman because he comes up in your book periodically as someone who sort of
the other Friedman,
but he advocates these policies while also holding to some sort of conviction for political democracy. How do they square this, that given, you know, that these countries are pursuing hostile economic policies, but with, in most cases, considerable popular support?
Well, they square it by declaring that whenever countries pursue economic policies that are against U.S. interests, they're not really democracies. That's when they start being called, populist quasi-dictators. And, you know, this is an old story. They did it starting with Allende. This attempt to a concerted propaganda campaign to paint Allende as a dictator in disguise. And what's interesting in the book is that I quote from declassified documents where the CIA is telling the Nixon administration that Allende, despite the propaganda campaign claiming he's in bed with the Soviet Union and is on the verge of turning Chile into a dictatorship, was actually a hardcore Democrat and was willing to accept votes that went against him, was allowing a very free and open press and so on. In terms of how they square it, I think that there simply isn't any intellectual consistency there. This has been true. This has been the hallmark of the Bush administration again and again: have elections, but don't dare vote for the people we don't like. It happens, in Lebanon, in Palestine, and in Iraq as well.
Our guest, Naomi Klein, our phone lines are lit up. Naomi, we've got a lot of people wanting to call in, so I'm going to turn the microphone over to our callers for a while now. Let's go to line one now. Charleston, Illinois, you're on the air with Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. First, thanks for writing a wonderful book. I'll be short about praise for the book, but everyone should read it. I think it's one of the most insightful things I've read since Chomsky came out with his seminal work. So my question goes back to kind of the beginning of your framework with the import substitution model. I was listening to an interview with Kevin Gallagher that Doug Henwood did recently, and they were pointing out that one of the factors that made people receptive to liberalization of markets was the cozy and corrupt relationship that existed between the industrial elite in these countries and the government. And so I was just wondering if you could speak more broadly about that, and perhaps also about what measures are being taken recently in recent movements, against global liberalization to deal with that kind of problem.
Mm-hmm. I think that what was happening with import substitution, and just so listeners who aren't familiar with the jargon understand what import substitution is. In Latin America, in the 50s and 60s, basically in the post-war period, there was a period of rapid industrialization, particularly in what's called the Southern Cone, Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, parts of Brazil, and the idea was to break the colonial economic patterns, the classic, what's sometimes called the banana republic model of just focusing on raw resources and exporting them to rich countries where they are then processed into much more expensive goods that are then imported by these same developing countries. So a classic example is coffee or chocolate. Growing the raw resources, exporting them to Europe or North America, having them processed and then re-importing them. So what import substitution was about was breaking these colonial chains that continues to keep so many developing countries in poverty, and using the revenues from the export of raw resources to develop an industrial base of their own, particularly in products that they were importing. Therefore, it was called import substitution. And in the early 70s, those import substitution policies, which had been very, very successful and had created in Argentina, had created the largest middle class in Latin America, were starting to stagnate. And there was a big debate about whether to take this process to the next level. And that's what Allende's election was really about, was about nationalizing the key assets, like the copper mines. But there was also a push to take it beyond individual countries and create a trading bloc, so that it was, they were able to have the benefits of economies of scale. And it was that process that I think was particularly threatening to Washington and to a lot of the American and European companies that were trading in these raw resources, the idea that Latin America would become an integrated market and would be able to compete with Europe and North America. And that process was interrupted with the wave of violent coups. And what's interesting about this moment in Latin America is that many of those ideas that were in the air in the late 60s and early 70s are now reemerging, and that's what I mean by the continent coming out of shock. But, you know, for me, this rejection of neoliberalism in Latin America, I happened to be living in Argentina in 2003. I was making a documentary film with my partner, Avi Lewis, about what was happening in Argentina after the economy imploded and there was a wave of factory occupations where workers occupied their factories and turned them into co-ops. So we were making a documentary film about this process. And it was this amazing moment in Latin America where this rejection of U.S.-imposed economic policies was spreading across the continent. And Lula had just been elected in Brazil, and Bolivia was gripped with mass demonstrations, and this was the process that eventually led to the election of Evo Morales. And in Argentina, they had overthrown 5 presidents in 3 weeks. So it was this period of tremendous ferment, and it was really amazing to be there in that moment and to watch the invasion of Iraq from Argentina. And that's what the roots of this book. That's why I wrote this book, I would say, because it really did feel at the time that it was no longer possible for this brutal economic model of total privatization, free trade, cuts to government spending. It was no longer possible to impose this model peacefully. And here we were in Latin America, where the whole continent was in revolt against these policies because they had failed so spectacularly to deliver on their promise of redistribution of wealth and trickle-down economics. So there was this revolt. And at that very moment, Iraq was invaded through shock and awe military force. And then along comes Paul Bremer announcing that Iraq is going to be the freest market in the world, that it was open for business, pushing through about 100 new economic laws that did turn Iraq into this laboratory for Friedmanite economics. And it was all the policies that had been imposed in Chile: flat tax, absolute free trade, privatization. So I wrote at the time that free trade had been upgraded from free trade light, where these policies were imposed through the IMF or trade agreements, to free trade heavy, where there was no negotiation, there was no veneer of consent. It was just grabbing new markets on the battlefields of preemptive war. And so, you know, I went to Iraq after I came back from Argentina to look at this evolution of what I'm now calling disaster capitalism, the use of disasters to push through this radical form of capitalism. But it was the research that made me realize that, in fact, what I thought was new had been happening now for 35 years, but we sort of missed it.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live today. Our guest is Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine. We've been talking about that book, and we have several callers patiently waiting to get back to Naomi Klein. So let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Lisa. I'm especially interested in your comments about Poland. I had been there recently, and my family immigrated from there. And what we see is not only a rise in sort of this extreme sort of Roman Catholic belief in some of its leaders, but we also see a lot of people voting with their feet. They're just leaving. A lot of youth is just leaving for England, like an enormous percent of its population, because they are feeling demoralized, and they're feeling really fearful. They have no secure sense, not only of income, but also where, you know, we have a lot of young, beautiful, brilliant people, and they don't have anywhere to take their genius. They don't have any sort of institution that wants to help them develop any of that. So I just wondered, do you have sort of an idea of how both communism and capitalism led to this sort of massive demoralization, and how, if you have any, strategies for those of us who might have our roots there, how we could help them find that strength again and themselves and their community. And I'll hang up now. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that call.
You know, Naomi, if I could just add one thing, because the book also has a really long discussion of Russia in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and Really, the process that took place there and the extraordinary corruption that went on, I mean, really unbelievable corruption and anti-democratic politics that led to the sort of emergence of the current Russian system. And I was just wondering, as you answer her question, if you also, are there any hopeful signs in Eastern Europe of democratization like we're seeing across Latin America, where be it Poland or Belarusia or Russia or Ukraine, are there places where we're seeing popular movements rising up?
Well, I think it's particularly hard in the former Soviet and the former communist countries as a whole, because there is such, because people are rejecting the shock therapy model, and there are these revolts against right-wing policies. But at the same time, there's a pretty persistent distrust of the left, because the left is associated with a history of totalitarianism and brutal systems. And that is why I think fascism does end up being the third way in these countries. We just had another example of challenging the claim that free markets and free people go hand in hand in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet states, with what just happened in Georgia, which just a couple of weeks ago was being held up by the Bush administration as an example of a country embracing free markets democratically and with a great human rights record. And really they were holding up Georgia as a counterexample to Putin's Russia. A little more than a week ago, there were huge protests in Georgia that were put down with tremendous police violence. 600 people were hospitalized. A state of emergency was declared. So there aren't that many good examples, is the short answer. But, you know, coming back to the caller, I think the most important question of what can be done, I think that this, there's an apologeticness about proposing progressive alternatives, precisely because of the legacy of communist authoritarianism in this part of the world, and so the gap is being filled by the far right, by nationalist anti-immigrant forces, and her question about what can be done, I think that there has to be some kind of left alternative that has some real confidence to say, you know, what Poland had under communism was not progressive. And I think, you know, Poland is a very, very difficult situation because they have been betrayed by everyone.
You know, it's ironic.
Solidarity was supposed to be that alternative, and people elected them with great hope, and then were betrayed by that experience. But, you know, I really do feel that if the ground is left, you know, if the vacuum is left, it will be filled with the politics of hate. We see that really clearly.
Our guest, Naomi Klein. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. We've got a lot of callers waiting patiently. Line 3, Champaign, Illinois. You're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Okay, first of all, it's an honor to speak with you. I saw you on a C-SPAN, an interview. Look forward to reading your book. A few quick questions. Poland. I believe Jeffrey Sachser, do I have the name right? He was an architect He is, excuse me, promulgating, or he's pushing some sort of anti-poverty worldwide cure. Is this connected with capitalism and the same type of capitalism that he pushed on Poland? Two, the United States seems to be drifting into even a more severe form of economic capitalism or shock capitalism of its own sort. Three, France. What is the chance of Sarkozy being able to completely just overturn their social safety net? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Right. Three great questions, Naomi.
There's a lot there.
There's a lot there. Go ahead.
Well, Jeffrey Sachs was the advisor to Poland's government in 1989 in the shock therapy period, and it was Sachs who told Poland's newly elected Solidarity government that if they accepted this sort of brutal economic shock therapy program, that they would end up as a normal European country. By normal European country, I think, you know, Poles were thinking of Germany and France, and Britain. And you know, the terrible irony, as the previous caller said, is that rather than turning into a normal European country, they're turning into a hollow country. And just spectacular numbers of young Poles are just leaving and going to those countries and working in hotels and restaurants and as plumbers and carpenters. And we just had a really awful incident in Canada where a 40-year-old Polish man who came here to work in the construction industry. I'm speaking to you from Canada. He flew to the Vancouver airport. His mother had moved here and was killed by our police using a taser. And just listening to that caller, I just realized this very horrific symmetry in the sense that, you know, he is one of the casualties of that economic shock therapy in Poland, came to Canada to look for a new life because he was an economic exile in Poland like so many others, only to lose his life to another kind of shock, to the shock of the taser gun. And that's another theme that comes up again in the book, of how shock is not just metaphorical, that often there are very real shocks to bodies that enforce these economic policies. And I think the militarization of our borders really is a part of that. It's a part of dealing with the discarded people of this economic model, the people who migrate looking for a better life, often meeting with very real, non-metaphorical shocks. The question of whether Sarkozy is going to be able to push through a real economic shock therapy program and get rid of France's social safety net, I wouldn't bet on it. I think France voted for change, but there is still a tremendous amount of support in that country for social protections, labor protections. And Sarkozy will eventually face a choice of how much repression he's willing to use to break the unions. This is the question that comes up again and again in my book, that eventually you do have a clash between the popular will and this economic imperative to deregulate and to privatize. And sometimes the politicians back down, and that's recently happened in Germany under Angela Merkel, where they did want to push through some so-called labor market reforms that would have taken away protections for workers. They were hugely unpopular. People protested, and Merkel backed down, didn't use violence. I expect that Sarkozy will probably make the same decision, but I think, you know, it highlights the theme of the book, that, you know, you do ultimately end up having to choose between the use of force and some kind of a compromise.
You know, Naomi Klein, I'd like to, there's so much in the book I do want to alert listeners to. There's a wonderful discussion of China, for example, likewise of South Africa in the late 1980s and early 1990s, and putting the lie to the notion that neoliberal policies were the policies of the dissidents and the revolutionaries in those countries, quite the contrary. But time, unfortunately, is not being very generous to us at this point. We don't have a whole lot of time left, and I do have some callers who do want to get on the air with you still. But, you know, I'm wondering if you look at Iraq today, because Iraq mm-hmm. plays such a central role in why you wrote the book and in the book itself, and we haven't had a chance to talk about it much. One of the things that struck me in your book, Naomi Klein, was neoliberalism's always been about privatizing everything, but having the government at least do sort of the police work and the military work.
Yeah.
And then when you talk about Iraq, they're privatizing that too.
Yeah. Well, I think that what we have seen over the past 25 years is this privatization frenzy that is really about since Reagan, that if we think of the state as a kind of an octopus, you've got the body at the center and then you have all of these limbs, that what's been happening over the past 25 years or so has been the lopping off of those limbs and feeding them to corporate America. So the water, electricity, roads, the airwaves, they've all been sort of systematically lopped off. And once you've and created really private monopolies in many cases, this is what's so exciting about privatization, is that it isn't the free market. And what it is the transfer of a public monopoly, usually to become a private monopoly. And it's really, in many cases, a license to print money, which is why corporations lobby so aggressively for new privatization opportunities. But so once you've lopped off all the arms, all that's left is the body, the core, what they call the core state functions. And those are, you know, the military, the border protection, the so-called first responders, the fire, the police. And you, these are the functions that are mandated in the Constitution, and that we tend to think of as, you know, impossible to privatize because they're so much so inseparable from what we think of as the role of government, as the role of the state. But the Bush administration is nothing if not bold, and this has really been, this will be the ultimate legacy of the Bush administration, that whoever takes power in 2008 will be entering a largely hollowed out shell of a government that still looks like a government, plays a government on TV, has all the trappings, you know, the presidential seals and press conferences and even the occasional policy battle, but you pull back the curtain and no one's home. And we catch these glimpses of the hollowness of the state that Bush and Cheney built, but really through scandal, right? I mean, we hear that Blackwater is accused of, you know, engaging in this massacre in Baghdad, and it's only in the controversy that follows that we discover the extraordinary level of dependence on private mercenary companies on the part of the State Department, that really the Green Zone can't function without Blackwater. Or in the midst of the Abu Ghraib scandal, we find out that private contractors are even engaged in prison interrogation. But it's this really odd kind of forensic accounting that where that if there is a scandal, if a company is accused of corruption or some sort of illegal activity, then we find out yet another function that's been privatized. And the point of this, you know, the book is about the shock doctrine, the use of shocks to push through unpopular policies. And the reason why we only find out about this privatization of core state functions retroactively is because there never was a debate. You know, there never was a public discussion about whether it was a good idea to outsource these central state functions to companies like Blackwater and Khaki. And that is the benefit of a shock, of a state of emergency, of a crisis. First, the shock of September 11th that gave the Bush administration absolute power to wage what it calls the war on terror however it wished, and how it wished was to outsource it and privatize it. But also the crisis, the ongoing crisis in Iraq, has created what I call a corporate mission creep, where the worse things get in Iraq, the more privatized the war becomes, the more functions private companies take over.
Let's go back to the phone lines now for one more caller who's been waiting very patiently. Line one, Chicago, if you're still there, you're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Yes, I think that what you've been talking about is fascinating. I can't help but see the parallels between 9/11 of the 70s and 9/11 of 2001. And I have to ask, do you think that it is possible that the 9/11 of 2001 was manufactured by some agency other than the agencies that we are being told that it was manufactured by? Thank you.
Well, then this 9/11 is certainly a harrowing symmetry. What the caller is referring to is that the coup against Salvador Allende, which was what I'm referring to as the start date for the economic revolution that the Friedmanite economic revolution that then spread throughout the world, that coup took place on September 11th, 1973. And then we have the shock of September 11th, 2001, which was the catalyst for this final stage of privatizing these core state functions. You know, I'm a reporter, I'm a journalist, and everything in my book I can prove. You know, the book has 60 pages of footnotes. On my website, we have the original source documents for every claim in the book. Because the book's been published around the world in multiple translations, I had 4 different lawyers check every single fact. And I'm very proud of that research, and I'm very proud that I'm only reporting on what I can prove. And, you know, that's what I do. And in terms of the idea that there could be have been other involvement in 9/11 that we don't know. I think that what I'm showing in the book is that it's less about these crises and shocks being planned in advance so that they can be exploited, and more what I call an acute state of disaster preparedness at the highest reaches of power, intellectual disaster preparedness. And as we've seen, they're not actually prepared to deal with disasters in the way that we would like them to, whether it's, you know, having planes ready for fires in California or first responders in New Orleans. We know that they don't have that kind of disaster preparedness, but what they have is intellectual disaster preparedness. And I start the book with a quote from Milton Friedman, who says, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. And when that crisis hits, the change that occurs depends on the ideas that are lying around." He wrote that in 1982. And I believe that much of the infrastructure of the right in the United States exists to be ready for crisis, and also to create an atmosphere of crisis around Social Security, border security, that then creates the context for more privatization, more of these transfers of wealth. So often it looks like a conspiracy, but actually it is just that state of high readiness to take advantage of a crisis because there is this understanding of the shock doctrine. And that's really why I wrote the book, because I know that this philosophy is deeply understood, and I have many quotes from people, from free market economists and politicians saying we need crises to push through these policies. And I think that regular people need to be ready for crises as well, to protect against this opportunism, but also to have their own ideas ready, which actually do enjoy popular support.
Our guest, Naomi Klein, today, we've only got a couple minutes left before the show ends. Naomi, this book goes so against the grain of the dominant media and political culture in the United States and the way people view the U.S. role in the world and view the relationship of markets and capitalism to democracy. What sort of response has the book gotten in the United States?
Well, it's been really a word of mouth success. I mean, it's been quite surprising and gratifying to me, because I was kind of expecting the book to be marginal in the U.S. and mm-hmm. mainstream elsewhere, which has been my experience with publishing in the past. My first book, No Logo, was a bestseller, across Europe and in Canada, but in the U.S. it was more like a college success.
An
indie band, which is a nice place to be. And I was expecting the same thing for the shock doctrine. And I actually have experienced something very different. And it isn't because the book received a lot of media attention, because most publications haven't reviewed it, with the exception of the New York Times. You know, it's been completely ignored by the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, and the LA Times hasn't reviewed it. I mean, it's pretty surprising, considering it did make it on the New York Times list, and it's really been selling very well. So what started to happen now is that because it's been this word of mouth success and the blogosphere has really embraced it, it's kind of forced some of the mainstream media outlets to pay attention to it. I just taped a show with Charlie Rose on Friday, it's starting to change. But as I tour with the book, and I've been really, really gratified by the audience reaction. And what I feel is that there's just a real hunger out there to go beyond the partisan politics. There's almost a feeling of pre-disappointment about the 2008 elections. No matter what happens, people know that when it comes to these issues around economic policy and certainly the privatization of the government, that there really is not a big difference between the parties, that the Democrats are being funded by the same infrastructure as the Republicans. And people want to understand the system that is underlying this. And what I find is that the audiences are there. You know, they are ready for this information, and they're ready to go beyond it too.
On that note, Naomi Klein, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to push me out of the studio.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much for being our guest today, Media Matters, Naomi Klein.
Bob, it was great fun. Thank you.
Sure thing. Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, just out from Metropolitan Books. I'll be back in 167 hours with Lance Bennett to talk about campaign coverage in the news today. Have a good week, everyone, and happy holidays.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.